Hello, and welcome to recording number 4 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is July 30th, 2021. We've just heard Gord relating what has happened to him between the end of the Saga of Old City novel and his joining the siege against Strandkeep Castle. He's been talking with Curly Greenleaf, and now Curly is going to relate what has occurred to him in that time period as well. I'm going to begin on page 36, paragraph 3. The druid related an uneventful and rapid return to the Celadon Forest, the dwelling place of the great druid from whom Curly Greenleaf sought counsel. The workings of the strange relic were as mysterious to that personage as they were to his lesser fellow. So the two had eventually gone to the Grand Druid himself. The result was still unsatisfactory, so nothing would do but for all three to seek the assistance of certain Hierophants, an arcane order of druidical priests, which Curly knew but little about. Much was learned thereby. Break. Not to be confused with the Hierarchs of the Horned Society. Here we have the Curly, who's an eighth order druid, and the great druid, and then the grand druid, who should be the single most powerful druid of Curly's order. I am going to restart. It is page 36, paragraph 4. What the relic was, and of what nature and origin, who placed it in its underground repository and guarded it with a demon, and the true powers it held, Greenleaf refused to enumerate. Perhaps he was himself ignorant. In any event, all the stocky fellow would tell his young friend related to but a single deomer of the relic. The object could be used to discover events elsewhere and elsewhen, including many other planes of existence, dimensions, and probabilities. It was thus empowered, Greenleaf related, to serve as a counterbalance to another ancient object, an artifact of blackest evil. Much more had occurred regarding the strange object before Curly, now given status as druid, a ranking member of the druidical hierarchy, gained permission to contact his long-separated companions. Thus, he had explained to Gord, a year had slipped away before he was able to come, bearing the rewards he had promised for their part in recovering the lost relic. Break. All right, now, in the time that, between when we were introduced to Curly and now, that being called druid is a 12th level druid, and is now... Curly is now of the rank, he's beyond the circles, and he is now one of the named, Druid is actually a class name in his druidical order, and there's only the Archdruid, who is called the Great Druid here, and the Grand Druid, who is called the Great Druid. I don't know if these Hierophants are beyond these levels, but it is the last leveled first edition druid is 14th, and in from the player's handbook called the Great Druid. All right. I am going to restart. It's page 36 and the second paragraph from the bottom. Much more had occurred regarding this... Oh, pardon me. I've gone through that. And I should mention here, that here's the first mention of the artifact of blackest evil here. So I assume it's probably, you know, what they were, what the book title refers to is this, because the relic that they got from the demon is actually supposed to be a counterbalance of this other evil artifact. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 36 and the last paragraph. From his bundle, Greenleaf brought forth a long, extraordinarily thin cloak of gray with soft boots to match. These, Gord learned, were of elfin make and bestowed near invisibility and almost perfect silence to their wearer. Curly also had magical wrist guards for the massive barbarian. Chert had often expressed contempt for armor and similar protection, so the druids had thought that such bracers would be most appreciated. Break. All right, so now Gord is wearing elfin chainmail plus one. He is wearing, he's now been given cloaks and boots of elven kind. I'm not sure, but I believe if you have the matching pair, they give an enhancement. I can't remember exactly offhand.
Pretty nice for a thief.
Oh, yes. I mean, perfect for a thief. Near silence and near invisibility. The little bit for the bracers for a barbarian, it's one of the few things that, you know, that the barbarian Chert would, you know, appreciate, as he as the barbarians do disdain, you know, armor and don't have a great care for magical items. But of course, these are going to be enchanted bracers. I don't know if they'll actually tell him that.
Maybe not.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 37, paragraph 2. Restoring the latter items to his pack, Greenleaf had then asked for the young thief's further assistance. Gord had surprised himself by jumping at the opportunity to find adventure and purpose. He agreed before even asking as to the nature of his friend's mission and needs. The druid seemed quite somewhat surprised at such ready acquiescence himself, and briefly related the circumstances of the fair to Gord. Geller, the veteran agent and spy, participant in many deeds of derring-do and countless skirmishes and battles, was involved. The bard had left off his endless missions for this or that sovereign head of state, abandoned his watch on the bandit kingdoms, Erdi, and all the rest. He had come instantly to the summons of the cable. By the time Curly came from his conclave with the Hierophants, Geller was already an integral part of the enterprise. He and Greenleaf had sped westward, and even as the druid was speaking with Gord, the one-eyed adventurer was gathering a force of like folk and mercenary soldiers below the city, working his way down the wild coast, bound for the Drakenscrab Hills. But Gord helped the effort by lending his skills and fighting abilities. Break. Oh, okay, so I guess I'm a little thrown. I didn't realize this was still before, it seems like it's still before the siege. And yeah, so this is before the siege and not afterwards. So Curly is still there. This is their way of relating what's happened to Curly. And now, again, with Gord joined up with Curly to go after Strandkeep. I had thought this was occurring after the attack on Strandkeep.
They're still getting reacquainted with Curly and explaining why Gord wound up in Strandkeep to begin with.
Okay. And then, you know, we do see Gord, you know, changing character a little bit where, you know, he jumps at the thought of adventure rather than even thinking about possible rewards. And the other thing is, this may be the first mention of the Cabal, Geller came instantly at the summons of the Cabal, and I believe that is a neutral, a group dedicated to the balance or neutrality.
Yeah, I don't remember hearing about it up until this point.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 37 and the third paragraph from the end. The force Geller was raising was to assist the Prince of Ulloch in his effort to take Strandkeep Castle and make war upon the men and humanoids of the Pomarge. Of course, Gord was ready, being more interested than ever in the undertaking. The young thief was clever enough to know that there was more to this than a simple military campaign, no matter the worth of that fight. Greenleaf had refused to speak of any other purpose, save joining with the dwarven monarch, and this whetted Gord's appetite for the whole business still more. Next day the pair had quitted the walls of Greyhawk for the countryside, and the long journey southward for the Pomarge. Thus had Gord come to the shores of the Azure Sea, helped to take the great fortress of Strandkeep, and dispatched many of its evil garrison, men-at-arms, and their masters alike. Okay, so now it seems like we're pretty close to the present time, post-battle here, it would seem. There's no mention of them knowing that the Scarlet Brotherhood was running that castle, but from the context, it seems like Curly and Geller must have been aware of further reaching things rather than just the business with the Prince of Ulloch wanting to expand and take over the gold and gem mines further on, as well as taking Strandkeep, which is the most powerful fort in the area. Right. I'm going to restart. It is page 37 and the final paragraph. He said, "A brass bit for your thoughts." Geller nearly shouted in his ear. Gord snapped out of his reverie and blinked rather foolishly at the hard-featured bard. "I was reflecting on the past. Sorry." "You might have no future unless you use your senses," the man replied sarcastically. "Keep the blank expression and don't look around. Keep your eyes on me." Still smiling, Geller added, "There are at least a score of Veerbeeg to our rear. I've seen them several times now. Those blasters can run, you know, and they're in a crescent formation behind us. I'd say that they want us to keep moving ahead into whatever ambuscade their fellows are preparing for us somewhere close ahead." Gord wanted to turn and see if he could spot the following Veerbeeg. He had heard of these giant-sized men, creatures 8 or 9 feet tall, often gross and deformed, but as mean as they were ugly. He had never actually seen one, for as fierce as the Veerbeeg were, they were hunted by men. An act of self-preservation, of course, for if given the opportunity, the Veerbeeg would rape, plunder, destroy, and destroy the communities of their smaller cousins. In these hills, it was not unexpected that such creatures would be found, dwelling in relative harmony with humanoid beasts and savage ogres and giant, as likely as not. Like, so here is a more exotic creature, a Veerbeeg. I can't remember if they are Fiend Folio or Monster Manual 2. I kind of think they're a Monster Manual 2 creature, but I might be wrong. It implies, too, that they are a kind of human rather than a part of the giants. It's just that it's that classification that there are you know, goblinoids, there are giants, and the Verbig just seem to be gigantic humans rather than giants themselves. All right. I am going to restart. We are on page 38, and this is paragraph 5. Gord looked quizzically at Geller. "What are we going to do?" he asked in a low tone. "Curly, tell that horse of yours to pull up as if he were lame," one-eyed Bard told his other companion. "Be quick." Soon Greenleaf was bending forward in his high-backed saddle. He patted the steed's neck. No distant onlooker would have noticed anything else. Suddenly, the big stallion began moving at an odd gait, limping and favoring its right foreleg, as if some stone had bruised its iron-shod hoof. "How's that?" the druid asked Geller. In reply, the one-eyed adventurer raised his hand, turned in his saddle, and called the column of men to a halt. "Rest," he called. "Greenleaf's mount is lame. I'll explain what we will do." As he shouted all this, he turned his own courser slowly, riding back to the various and sundry lieutenants and minor spellwalkers who rode near the head of the column. After a brief conversation there, these men rode back along the column of lancers and mounted sergeants with crossbows, all the way to the handful of officers and tough adventurers who guarded the company's rear. Four files of riders quickly split into two halves, one spreading out casually to the left, the other to the right, while the tail of the column moved forward. This maneuver was not done with seeming precision. Horses were reined only loosely, heads low and allowed to graze. There was certainly a plan behind it, however, and Gord noted that the animals' movements were quietly guided by knees and heels. Everyone seemed quite relaxed, though even as the former column suddenly shaped itself into a line, two ranks deep, lancers to the rear, crossbowmen and the rest up in front. "What is Geller doing?" the puzzled young thief asked his friend. Why are we forming for a charge with our lancers behind? And what reason to charge ahead into some undiscovered ambush?" "Don't be a hottie peak, my lad. Old Geller may have only one real eye, but his brain and wits more than make up for it," Curly said bluffly. "Now you pay attention to him and be ready for a rapid charge." Break. All right, Chris has put up the little bit about Ulic here from either the 83 set or the folio, and also the Monster Manual, the Monster Manual 2, a picture and the stats of the Verbig. Not my favoritely named creature, but I guess Gygax had no objection to it. Now, in the section we just read, we have the difference. Now, what's not mentioned right here, it was mentioned previously that when they left Strand Keep, they had about 100 men with them. So here, but they were riding in column, which is, you know, a long line with only a few in together and stretching out. And now they've stretched from column into line, which is, again, like a little Wargamers thing. Line is the best way to face or to get prepared charge for enemy. Gygax's wargaming past is showing right here. It's, you know, also we're showing again that Gord is learning, you know, what is Geller doing? So Gord, who is not experienced, you know, especially with mounted warfare, a little bit at Woodsford with regular warfare, but now, he's experiencing something a little different. He's now been through, saw his first siege. So we're seeing, you know, a lot of warfare here all at the beginning of this book. And Gygax goes into, you know, some detail of explaining, you know, what the ranks are too deep with the Lancers, rear and crossbowmen, and the others, which would probably be, you know, somebody differently armed fighters, or and also the magic users and such that are along with them. Now, one last thing is that Curly calls Gord a hottie peak, and I believe that the character he was called by Evely, an elvish insult, and I believe that two of them, I know Hottie Peak is an NPC, and so was what was that called, Fonken, and I might have been Fonken Hottie Peak, which is rather amusing, is it? Like, either Hottie Peak is somebody who was well known, or it in itself is also some kind of disparaging comment. Fonken Hottie Peak, yeah. And Fonken, we learned, is the Elvish term for, I believe, ignorant. And so Fonken Hottie Peak, I guess, is a double insult for that male high elf from the Giant series.
Yeah, I think it was like Little Fool or something like that.
Yeah, for Fonken.
Yeah.
So I wonder what Hottie Peak means too, because it's definitely being used as don't be a Hottie Peak here.
Maybe Gary's just alluding to the character.
I wonder if that player, you know, did something rather ignorant.
There you go.
And ended up as Fonken Hottie Peak, or just a Hottie Peak may have become, you know, an insulting term for anybody after that character's play. Now, the G-Series was originally a tournament series, you know, and you kind of rushed through it. And you can see in that old module the some of the tournament-isms that are in it, like having the scene with them all in the hall. You know, it was just what you were meant to encounter as you rushed through to complete that first module. So here we have a Hottie Peak, and last novel we had a Funk. And all right, I'm gonna restart. It is page 39, and the third paragraph from the end. Almost as if that were a cue, the grizzled adventurer suddenly brought forth his longsword and gave it a wave. Without any further orders, the two long lines suddenly wheeled to face the rear. Now lieutenants barked orders, and as the horsemen began advancing in the direction from which they had come, mounts moving at a slow walk, a slight shift of the rear rank brought the crossbow-armed riders into the intervals between the lancers, and from there they could loose their bolts without fear of hitting their fellows. Greenleaf and Gord were at the center, a sort of third rank, along with Geller and a pair of veteran mercenary lieutenants. Light groups had taken station at either wing, obviously meant to guard the flanks of the formation. "Charge!" cried Geller in a stentorian voice that could have been heard a quarter-mile distance. The walking horses began to trot and quickened their gait to a canter. The ground was too even for a full gallop, and even a charge such as this was not likely to prove as devastating as one normally would. Nonetheless, Gord was glad he was not standing before the thundering lancers and sergeants of the company as they moved thus. Without warning, huge men sprang up from behind bushes and other cover that Gord would never have supposed would hide such tall savages. The Verbeeg were clad in an odd assortment of armors. Some had fur hides and pelts, others scraps of armor attached to to hide coats. Burnies taken from who knew where were crudely converted into jacks to protect the upper bodies of these lean giants. Some bore shields of human make, others crude ones obviously fashioned by their own hands. Each bore an equally motley assortment of weapons. Most carried crude clubs and rough spears. Few had like weapons of somewhat superior craftsmanship. Here and there were pole arms and great swords, recognizable as having once belonged to men. Bardich and massive two-handed mace were held with one-hand nonchalance. Were held with one-handed nonchalance by these behemoths. Into this suddenly revealed force, the horsemen charged without hesitation. A flurry of bolts was sent speeding toward the very big savages, just as the lancers in the front rank lowered their flame-pinioned weapons. Light crossbows carried by the men of the second line were quickly slung on pommels, so that the sergeants could ply other weapons in the coming melee, sword, axe, or whatever weapon the soldier chose. Then the charging horsemen struck their enemies with a crash of steel on steel. Not a few of the leading riders or their steeds had been brought down by the heavy spears that the human giants hurled at the closing horsemen. Undaunted, the charge went home. The lancers' impacts tumbled very big, and riders too. Maddened stallions bit and sent vicious kicks with skull-crushing force as they reared and came down. Helmets spun through the air, as did severed heads and broken weapons. Sabering blows and vicious thrusts then fell upon those of the human giants who still stood, as the second wave of riders fell upon them. A half dozen of their most savage members still stood and fought, with bloody bardich hacking or two-handed swords slashing death, but a score of their fellows lay dead in a matter of minutes. A rapid check to left and right showed Gord that the flanks were secured. The expert fighting men and lesser magic users there worked in conjunction to destroy the few towering Verbig coming at the mealing company thus. Geller had been singing a heroic chant ever since the charge began, his voice somehow carrying above the thundering hooves and the din of battle afterward. The druid was also engaged in an activity, moving toward the rear to watch for the expected coming of fresh foes, brought from hiding by the shouts and sounds of the struggle. Evidently, Greenleaf thought this threat was serious for two associated druids, the chief magician of the company, and a swarthy Chakyuk, a slant-eyed, bandy-legged fighter of great prowess, renowned for his terrible horned bow, went with him as he retraced the route over which the company had just passed. All right, break. It's a note that how strong the Verbig is, their strength ranges from 18/51 to 18/100. So, they are in, almost what giant strength would be. So their range is the upper level to the, highest level for a human. And they are supposed to be, they are 9 to 10 feet tall, and of odd shape, odd features, and, usually some of them very heavy, but the one we're seeing here just looks very big in the illustration. Now, I'm noting here, Gygax does a very great, does very well with description of battle. We're not getting a normal kind of blow by blow. These are, like about ogre sized with hit dice 5+5. But the lance charge, the crossbows, and, the overwhelming number of the horsemen, because there should have been about 100 to the 30 that were in the back rank. The 30 Verbig that were behind them, that should really take a toll. and it should in a day AD&D mechanics kind of thing where these Verbig would have a lot of hit points, they're not the best armored. So being struck by these lances, they should cause a great deal of damage. And then the follow-up, and probably being struck by more than one lance. And here we have that word, the Chakik. They are the tiger nomads. I believe that the word Chakik sounds a little bit like a Mongolian term to me. For those, you know, our own Earth's nomadic people. And I'd always felt that was pretty much where, you know, the tiger nomads were based on, you know, were the actual Mongol horse nomads who had, you know, ravaged, under Genghis Khan, who had ravaged China and the East, and, you know, even got as far as, I know they drove the king out of Hungary. They might have come up to Vienna. They destroyed 3/4 of the warriors in Islam at the time, and brought an end to, I think, the caliphate. So this bowman promises to be, you know, an exceptionally powerful warrior with a bow, as that is what they were known for. All right. I'm sorry, I'm going to restart here. And it is page 40. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's page 41 and is paragraph 2. Virtually left alone, the young adventurer looked for the most likely place where his swordsmanship might be of use. A heavily armored Verbig, laying bloody bodies in dismembered rows about him, was nearby. The fellow seemed to be inspiring the few remaining giants to rally, and Gord was disconcerted to see that a few more of the monsters were yet uncommitted, hanging back to see if they should fight or flee. Setting his heels sharply into his warhorse's flanks, Gord rode to attack the giant, his blade held spear-like before him, aiming his course so as to sweep past the Verbig chieftain and allow the point to drive home. Dude busy fending off thrust lances and flashing blades to take the additional threat of a single horseman seriously, the human giant was an easy target for a sword as keen and an aim as artful as Gord's. The impact of delivering the blow spun the young thief sideways, and he almost fell from his seat atop the courser. Only the high cantle of the saddle saved him. The Verbig was reeling, Gord's sword embedded in his side, but still somehow managing to fight the men before him. Without thinking, Gord vaulted from his steed's back, ran toward the giant, and sprang through the air, leaping high and driving his long, enchanted dagger through the steel plate that protected the chieftain's huge back. Verbig gave an awful, bull-like bellow at the attack and fell dead, for the dagger had struck him a mortal wound. All right, break. So, again, Gord manages a backstab, and I believe now at his level it's doing something like quadruple full damage from that backstab, maybe even quintuple. So, you know, a huge, first the short sword is driven into the Verbig's side, and then the long tooth, obviously unenchanted armor, passes right through the steel plate that the Verbig is wearing and causes him a mortal blow. You know, these are, you know, very interesting. It's hard to tell if Gygax does seem to still be following the idea of going through the AD&D mechanics for these combats. And I know it's a story, but I do seriously wonder how much of dice rolling there is going on in the story, because he is writing, he's writing to show how the battle would go and how it would seem, even from the mechanical point of view, but expressed as a dramatic narrative, and always something that a DM and a player can look at to, you know, spice up their own battles is a better, more lively description. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 41, the final paragraph. The skulking remainder of the band was sent flying by well-shot quarrels, and the whole affair was done. Over a score of the company was dead, or soon would die of wounds, and as many were injured. Explosive sounds, deep shouts of giant voices, and then more bangs and crackles sounded from beyond a hill that they would have passed over had the squadron ridden on unaware of the ambush. Gord had regained his wits and his sword, found his horse and remounted. He peered at the hill. Brilliant, silvery light sprang up and died as quickly. Then a rainbow of jarringly wrong colors shot into the air. An arcing boulder made a momentary appearance in its flight, and then fell from vision. More boulders appeared similarly, and their impact could be felt from where Gord watched, as the sound of their crashing and shattering could be heard. With that, the air above the source of these flying stones seemed to become red hot, actually turning a maroon color and shimmering, while waves of tawny flame undulated in it as eels swim in water. Bellowing and titanic howls arose, but no boulders did so. A full minute elapsed with nothing more. The company was gathering its wounded, readying the horses, stripping the dead of anything that they, still living, might use. Over the crest of an intervening hill came Curly Greenleaf and his henchmen, riding like the wind, although no enemy pursued them. Geller galloped his horse part of the way to meet the group. "What happened, Greenleaf, my old friend?" he called as the handful of men brought their horses to a skidding stop. "Are you chased by invisible stalkers and fiends of the ether?" "Don't attempt poor jests now," the sweating druid called back. "There must be 100 hill giants, Verbigan ogres back there. We gave them hell. A couple of the bigger ones, probably mountain giants, began tossing rocks at us. We hit them with a lick or two of magic, and that stirred up a hornet's nest. I'd say that there are a dozen of those big bastards back there with the rest." "What do you think they'll do?" Geller asked in a worried tone. "Come boiling after us in a minute," cried the druid. "Even though we did for a bunch of them, there's more than enough left to do the same for all of us. Can we make a fast detour to the west?" the one-eyed man said laconically. He waved to the surviving members of the company to follow, and then trotted his horse to the left, angling slightly southward, and bringing the animal to a faster pace as he reached the head of the column that had formed. Lord Greenleaf and the rest spurred their mounts to catch up, for huge heads were appearing on the hill crest, giant heads. The rest would soon follow, and not one of the men cared to stay and see if the creatures in this horde were interested in surrendering. Great. All right, that is the end of this chapter, page 43. I always like doing a break at the end of the chapter. This was chapter 3. All right, now quite a battle there. That one of the interesting things I find is that the huge amount of different kind of giants and giant kin or largest, because here we have hill giants, mountain giants, which I'm not sure if they're also a Monster Manual 2 creature. Now, Gygax, in the previous book, he was introducing a lot of information from I believed unearthed arcana. And in this one, we're seeing a lot of stuff coming, I believe, from Monster Manual 2. Now, this is a 1987 release, this book. So I'm wondering if we're looking at a lot of the kind of information released in different books from that period, 86 and 87. So it is very interesting to hear about this large force of mixed giants, mountain giants, ogres, Veerbig, and in such numbers that they can ambush, a column of 100 men. So this isn't just some small group. This is enough to, bring down a town. You know, there's enough, or even, I don't know, even a small city would have a hard time, mainly because the giants are like movable catapults, and they can cause such severe damage that they can bring down walls, toss things over the walls. They can really throw a lot of rock there. And being such huge, high Hittite, high hit point, lots of damage, they can really crush, definitely crush a town, even a walled town. So that's very interesting. Yeah, I would say, sounds like, because Gygax really doesn't do think too many things that don't have, a built-up reason. And to encounter this just on their ride, it seems like this ambush may have been directly for them, and not just an ambush for anyone. Yeah, so I'm not sure where mountain giants are introduced. I guess they're not in Monster Manual 2. Perhaps they're from the Fiend Folio. All right. I'm going to restart. It is going to be chapter number 4. And we're just starting out with that. And it is page number 45, first paragraph. The remainder of their trek through the hills was rather anticlimactic. A brush with some passing brigands and a few incidents with prowling carnivores of typical sort were all that occurred. Before a week was out, the force came to the verge of the Sus Forest, the place where the easternmost arm of the woodlands came to a halt upon the northernmost slopes of the Drakenscrobs. Early and his three attendant druids were most relieved and happy to be there. Gord and most of the others didn't share the prospective joys of the forest, for the Sus was renowned for its dangerousness, being the high road for humanoids and various less desirable creatures seeking haven in the wilderness of the Pomarge. When such traffic existed, predators found it to be a ready, steady food source and settled down to inhabit the region. Okay, over here in the text channel, Chris has found the Fiend Folio entry for the Mountain Giant. The Mountain Giant is, an extraordinarily powerful creature for first edition. He's a 12 hit die. He only does one attack, but 4 to 40 damage. And he can hurl a rock as a special attack for 2 to 16 points for the hurled stone. So, they are very powerful, and to run into a little group of them, that really makes that a very powerful ambush, sporting 12 hit die monsters. Now, one of the things we're running across, here's the mention of the Sus Forest, gives us some location details with the Drakenscrobs. The woodlands east comes upon the northernmost slopes of the Drakenscrobs. Now, yes, and the Sus, is well known. The Sus is well known for how dangerous it is, and it is the entry point for a lot of northern humanoids making their way to the Pomarge, which after is, you know, is it does have castles and keeps and stuff, but it is a wilderness and a very evil place. All right. I am going to restart. It's page 45, paragraph 2. Any creature that hunted orcs, bugbears, and ogres was bound to be a tough customer for anyone else to face, including seasoned adventurers such as these troops were. Furthermore, lancers on horseback were entirely out of their element in timber. Just as Geller had predicted, the tenants of the company met and voted that the men ride east to seek employment with the Lord of Elred. That was that. A few remaining members of the sundered company were formidable enough without the mercenaries who had ridden away, and they were certainly varied. Geller, the bard, Curly Greenleaf with his three aspirant druids in tow, Ward, the Chakyak barbarian, Jakote, and three mercenary adventurers who thought their prospects were higher with such as this group, Flan name in Kosi, and two crossbowmen called Moon and Patrick, respectively. The latter two were appreciative of the care Curly had given them, his druidic power saving both men from death due to wounds suffered in the fight against the Verbig. Now both determined to be obligated to him, and the druid was less than pleased about that, but could not dissuade either one. All right, break. So we have this adventuring company here. And, you know, yes, Gygax is, you know, really relating how helpless, you know, horsemen and especially lancers would be in thick forest. That makes me think back to Saga of Old City, where Gord is being chased by these soldiers from the Pale after he had stolen a holy chalice. And they make their way through this thick forest there, and it always seemed on horseback, and it seemed very strange to me at the time that they could be doing so. Dense forest is just, you know, a terrible place for a man on horseback unless he's carefully walking it through. And then we also think back to the Battle of Woodsford, where you know, the cavalry came forward, but also the men armed with poles. And I've always, you know, understood that pole arms were next to useless, you know, in a thick forest. There'd be too many branches, too hard for them to maneuver it. You could only use them by, like, jabbing ahead, and you wouldn't be able to use pole arms in mass. So these lancers have now chosen to go, they're mercenaries, and so this entering the Sus Forest is beyond what they want to do. Now, we've had mention here of, you know, the people accompanying Gord and Geller and Curly, but what I'm surprised is there were also supposed to be groups of some magicians, but I guess that those magicians might have been part of that mercenary group, and they've almost all left to go for with Lord Elred, which seems to say to me that that mercenary group is an actual, you know, formed band. And too bad Gygax didn't give them a name, because it seems like they would have been a known band rather than just a stray group of mercenaries. All right. I am going to restart, and it is page 46, paragraph 2. Before night fell, the 10 adventurers comprising the band rode northeast out of the hills and along the edge of the Sus Forest, taking care to leave as little sign of their trail as possible. If any followed the company, they were likely to take the obvious track left by the larger group and ignore the few who and off in another direction. That is what Geller wished. Before I leave you, the half-elven druid and ranger told his comrades, I must reveal what has transpired. About time, Curly, Gord interjected. This is a long story, Gord. If any of you hope to sleep this night, I suggest that you interrupt infrequently, if at all. The rotund druid paused and looked around at the faces of his companions, letting the seriousness of his statement sink in. Very impressive, you half-breed reprobate, Geller contributed. But let's cut the theatrics, or your account will be spun until dawn. He enjoys his role, you know, Geller said, now addressing the others, for it isn't often that everyone has to listen to this windbag. Now we must. I refuse to rise to your baiting. The views of a one-eyed old scoundrel are necessarily, limited in their perspective. Smiling gently at his own wit, Curly Greenleaf launched into his exposition without further delay. The result of my efforts, that is the combined work of Gord here, our missing associate Chert, a steely-eyed and thick-hued barbarian, and me, of course, released a powerful relic into the proper hands. That is to say, the object was somehow brought from its obscurity and inaccessibility by forces beyond our understanding at the time of its need. Supernatural influences seemingly utilizing we three, and now the druidical circles and the hierophants too, to further their ends. As to the nature of these unknown powers, I cannot speak, for I know aught of them, and only suppose their actuality. Of the relic, however, I can speak with considerable enlightenment, understanding given to me by the others, including our companion Geller. The object of power enabled concerned parties to uncover a great plot. The relic is the counterbalance to an artifact of the most malign forces ever known to this world. These forces of evil are epitomized, if not actually controlled, by the lost god Tharizdun, he who is wrapped in ebon slumber. Should that one awaken, all beings of malign power, all bad things, every evil creature must bend their neck to him. Listen carefully to my saying. The dukes of hell, the princes of the abyss, and all those baneful rulers of the plains between devil and demon must and will be united under Tharizdun's wicked might. Eons ago, he was entrapped by those deities who understood that this greatest evil must be fettered, or all goodness would perish from this world, and possibly the entire multiverse. Acting in concert, these entities managed to enmesh Tharizdun in a manner that turned his own evil upon him, slowly spinning a cocoon of power that, being of his own making, wrapped and entrapped him in a way he could not avoid. Because it was a web spun from his own malign deeds, and drawing upon his very forces, the terrible one of utter darkness would not willingly finish the work. Too late to untangle the bindings, he could still exist and wield a limited wickedness, bound as he was. Thereupon, those who had conjoined to create this subtle snare had then to complete their task. They did so, but Tharizdun understood too, and used his still mighty force to resist. Those who struggled against him had hoped that Tharizdun himself would complete the web, thus bringing about his own annihilation. A forlorn hope indeed, considering the greatness of Tharizdun's wicked and malign power. No binding they could make could destroy him. They enwrapped him in blackest realms, in a slumber so total that only faint echoes of Tharizdun's vileness could exude from him. Still, these faint dreams of his empower empower much of the evil that permeates the lower planes, being also of other making, that the mesh that entraps him of utter darkness is imperfect. Of necessity, it contains an opening, a means of unraveling the weaving, loosing the bonds. Tharizdun sleeps, but is not dead. The key to unlock, cut, break, and open the prison is here. Hidden in various places on our own earth. Break. All right. Well, first off, Chris has found added the picture to the fiction chat here of Curly relating his story. I'm always a little surprised at Curly's depiction here. But here he's not looking quite as rotund as they talk about. Yes, and Chris, you know, yeah, Chris relates that too.
He is great.
Yeah, he is surprisingly thin here. So here we have the introduction here of Tharaston, and you know, quite a bit of information drop here, and you know, we get our first mentions of the multiverse. Talks of the different planes, the Dukes of Hell, the Princes of the Abyss. Also, they talk about these various deities, but do not name them, which, you know, I think is a shame. Just that they resisted Tharaston and somehow managed to bind him. Now, we get a lot of this from Monster Manual 2. That details, you know, a lot of the, especially the Dukes of Hell, I think, are mostly detailed in Monster Manual 2, whereas a lot of the demons are detailed in Monster Manual 1. But yeah, Monster Manual 2 has quite a lot in them. Now, Chris relates about that picture that's Jeff Easley. Definitely moved from Clyde Caldwell from the first book. Caldwell, you know, he did some very stark stuff, but I really, you know, his stuff had a certain, almost iconic look to it. But this stuff by this picture by Easley, I think I really like what he's done with this little picture here. And I think I tend to like Easley a little bit better than Caldwell.
Caldwell did the cover, and Easley does all the interior art in this book.
Oh, okay. Yeah, definitely that's a Caldwell cover there. You can even see the CC in the bottom right of the front cover. So, I've liked this Easley illustration. We have... I'm wondering, one of the things that comes to me is, you know, the entire series deals with Tharaston. And I'm just wondering if what Gygax's plans were at this point, you know, for the continuation, or even if he was thinking of an ending of the story, he probably was thinking of some ending for the Tharaston, you know, storyline, whether it was going to end the series or whatever. But here, it's still coming out from TSR. So it really makes me wonder, you know, it's you know, further down the road, there's another five books in this series. So it really makes me wonder what plans he had and whether he changed them in light of, you know, him being forced out of TSR. And he may have changed this story, you know, the ending. I don't think that books, at least the last three books, were written. City of Hawks, Dance of Demons, and Come Endless Darkness. I don't think those, well, I got them out of order, but I don't think those were written. Gygax might have planned them. He seems to have been a big... writer of notes, and he might have planned out this story quite a bit earlier than he actually wrote it. I think this is a pretty good place. We've had the explanation and the first introduction. Really, there was a mention of Tharaston that the in Strandkeep Castle that the leader, that priest, was a priest of Tharaston, and it was an important religion to the Scarlet Brotherhood, but I got the idea that it wasn't the only religion in the Scarlet Brotherhood. But now here we have a good, you know, a little detail on Tharaston. You know, more as a kind of force of evil than anything else, you know, without any kind of other history to him or what pantheon, if any, belonged to. So, you know, I think I'll stop here and continue on with the next recording. And still we're getting a lot of exposition right here, and we haven't, in the end of this chapter, I think we're going to hear a lot more, more coming from Curly. I don't think his tale is finished. So I'm going to call up Craig, and one note, I hope this recording sounds a little better than I guess some of the recent ones have been.
Sounded very good.
Well, I know there's been mention that there's been some problems in the recording itself when it's played back. Now, I've done this one on the old Chromebook and not the new laptop, so maybe we can work hear a difference. And, you know, whether you're listening to this in archive, but especially if you're listening to this in archive and you've listened to recording, you know, 1, 2, 3 in Artifact of Evil, and recording number 4 sounds different from the in the archive, that could be the reason. I was hearing that there were pauses and slowdowns and even some gaps of silence. So, you know, I'm hoping that's fixed, but I'm a little sad that it's not. You know, I'm a little sad that it may be the new laptop. Jeez. All right, I'm going to say good night.